we all know that going for refuge, we should all know by now that going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is the very heart of the Western Buddhist order, and therefore of the Friends of the Western Buddhist order. It's the essence of our order, going for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. Ordination into the Western Buddhist order happens when your effective going for refuge, as we call it, is witnessed by your private preceptor in the course of the private ordination, and witnessed again by your public preceptor in the public ordination. This term effective, by the way, I'm going to go into quite a bit later on in the series, because it's being used in a very special sense in the context of our order. But anyway, you all know that. I hope you all know that. That's the essence of ordination, the witnessing of your effective going for refuge. And we really emphasise this so, so very much. Your ordination training is a training for this, for the witnessing of your effective going for refuge. And we speak of going for refuge so much, it's very easy when you speak of something a lot for it to become somewhat trite. Can even become a sort of formula. It's even just an initial, isn't it? You hear GFR, I'm a GFR Mitra, for example. And it becomes a shorthand. It even becomes sort of, you know, it kind of loses its moorings even in what it's really all about. It's going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And when, because you sometimes hear people saying things like, sort of justifying all sorts of things, it is really helping my GFR. In order to GFR, in order to go for refuge, I need to do this, etc. And when you actually hear what they're talking about, it's as almost as if they're just talking about what makes them feel better, what makes them feel good, or a rather vague general idea of some sort of notion of growth and development, but not necessarily in the direction of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It's as if, well, I'm an order member, I'm a man who've asked for ordination, so I must be going for refuge, so anything I do must be to do with that, must be an expression of that. But of course that isn't the case. That isn't the case. Going for refuge, if we're doing this with the term going for refuge, GFR, it's becoming a sort of label, kind of flag waving. It's becoming a kind of identity, a self-view. And it's a matter of sort of outward words and gestures and slogans. It's very easy to slip into that, very easy for us to slip into that. So we need to watch for that and be on our guard against turning this profound spiritual experience, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, into a sort of rather empty label. We need to remind ourselves constantly of its real meaning, constantly, daily, its deep meaning, its profound meaning. And thanks to Sangharakshita, we're also able to can be reminded of its vast scope and range. That book, The History of My Going for Refuge, I've been sort of looking into it again in preparing these talks, and I really, it's an amazing booklet. It's deceptively sort of simple in a way. You can read it quite quickly, but what he's describing is something of great sort of great profundity, and you realise that going for refuge is really never ending. It's never ending, a never ending exploration of the mysteries of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha on all kinds of levels. So we need, first of all, in setting off on our journey on this retreat, to remind ourselves that for the earliest Buddhists, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha was indeed a profound spiritual experience. Going for refuge was the expression of a profound revolution in consciousness and being that was expressed in action. It doesn't seem to have been originally a ceremony, although a ceremony of going for refuge arose out presumably of that particular experience. So you probably all know the sort of thing I'm talking about. Someone would come to the Buddha, they'd have an encounter with the Buddha. They may have been a wanderer like him, maybe they'd gone forth from home into homelessness and were searching for some sort of spiritual path or on some sort of spiritual path. Maybe they were from a different tradition from the Buddha. They may have been a wealthy merchant, a businessman, or they might have been a poor man or a beggar or a farmer or a housewife or a queen or a king or a courtesan, young or old. Sometimes it would just be a chance encounter. They just sort of bumped into the Buddha, on the road or something like that. Sometimes they went along to a formal talk. Sometimes, in the case of one particular character who was a leper named Supa Buddha, he just saw a crowd and he thought, food, good place to get food. So he kind of drifted over to kind of, be around people where there'd be food. And there's the Buddha giving a Dharma talk, a Dharma communication. And the Buddha, he's sort of, his consciousness is right out there. And he's looking at the people listening and he said, who's going to really get this? And it's Supa Buddha. Supa Buddha's never, the leper has never thought of Buddhism before. He's just there for the food. He's an outcast, just wants the grub that might be on offer. And the Buddha directs his discourse to Supa Buddha, and he gets it. He gets it. His Dharma eye opens. He enters the stream. He goes for refuge. Extraordinary. It wasn't what he was expecting when he kind of went around that assembly. Whatever, in whatever way it happens, sometimes, as in the case of Supa Buddha, something happens in the course of the communication. The Dharma would emerge. The Dharma would get through to that person, they would see it. Sometimes they would see it directly, there and then. Their Dharma eye, as the idiom has it, their Dharma chakshu, their Dharma vision, the vision of the truth, would just open there and then through the communication, precipitating this great shift in consciousness, this turning around in consciousness, and they would give expression to that experience very fully. They would sort of break into verse to try and explain, try and communicate what had happened. So typically they would say these amazing words, magnificent Lord, or wonderful Lord, Bhagawan, magnificent. The Dharma, the truth, has been made clear in many ways by the Blessed One. It's as if that which had been knocked over is now upright again. It's as if that which was hidden is now revealed. It's as if the way is now shown to one who was lost. It's as if a lamp has been lit so that those with eyes can now see the forms before them. And it's very interesting that they use images to describe their experience, a very direct way of communicating what had happened to them. There's a kind of sense of rightness about the Dharma that's communicated to them. Before them, life was a bit of a mess, a bit chaotic. It was, thrown down on the ground. Now it's set up right. There's something reliable about what they've heard. Something hidden that perhaps they've sensed has now been revealed, has now been made known. Maybe they've had that sense that there was something, but they couldn't get to it. But now it's revealed, it's opened up. And they have a way. They've been sort of floundering around, lost on the sort of paths of life, in the wilderness of life. And now there's a way, there's purpose. There's a purpose to existence. And now they can see everything clearly. And it's interesting perhaps to reflect on our own kind of images of and metaphors to describe that kind of experience. These are the images that the early Buddhists typically used. But we probably all have our own metaphors for that sense when we discover the Dharma. A very common one is that sense of coming home. That's a very common one. It's used again so much that we think, oh, well, it's a sort of cliche, but originally that's an experience. You sort of have that sense of, this is my place, this is my people. I suppose the whole notion of coming home has a kind of, there's a notion of sort of refuge in there as well. Or just that sense of sort of recognition. This is my language. I think that was the sort of sense I had. These are my words when I first connected with the Dharma. This is the way I speak. This is my lingo, so to speak. So it's very important to recall those images that you might have had, for that sense of recognition when you first intuited and saw the Dharma. Try and get back to that experience. But for the early Buddhists, this isn't the end of their expression. It's not just expressed in these very, in a way, homely but very strong, powerful images. They would say after that, the person would say, "To the Buddha for refuge I go. To the Dharma for refuge I go. To the Sangha for refuge I go." It's a very, very powerful expression, which is perhaps hard for us to feel the full force of in the relative safety and convenience of our particular world. In the ancient world, and of course in some parts of the contemporary world, of the modern world, you know, that sense of refuge, that sense of safety and security was a very pressing need. So to say, "To the Buddha for refuge I go," has enormous significance and power and force. It's saying that the Buddha is the source of all security, safety. It's also a powerful expression of discipleship, of commitment. There's an element in it of surrendering, of surrendering to the teacher, and making a commitment to him and to his teaching and path and to his community. So it's a very, very powerful expression. And that commitment is forever, because the person would then say, "From today, Bhagawan, accept me as your follower, as one who goes for refuge to you as long as breath lasts." As long as breath lasts. For the whole of one's life, in other words. Or perhaps even with every breath, in every breath, in every moment, I will go for refuge to you. Every moment is a moment to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. With every breath I go for refuge. So this was the experience of the earliest disciples of the Buddha. Going for refuge is the expression, is also a profound spiritual, even transcendental experience. Their life is utterly changed from that moment. So in those images used by the early Buddhists to express their experience, I noted that there's a kind of sense of rightness. The Buddha's teaching reveals this is the way things are. This is what is really there. The Dharma lights up, reveals what's there, and it reveals that there is actually a way. So there's nothing sort of artificial here. It's an important detail, this, that going for refuge, the Dharma, is not something added on to life. It's not something artificial, imposed upon life. It's the very essence of life. And practicing the Dharma, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we're actually living more in accordance with the way things actually are. We're living in accordance with what is deepest within us. We're living from what is deepest within us, from the deepest of human nature. Because sometimes practicing the Dharma, going for refuge, doesn't actually feel like that. It can feel as though it's as if something's been imposed. We're doing the prostration practice this afternoon, and I think I said to people, well, at first it will just seem really weird. You know, trying to hold this visualization, do this physical prostration, say these things. I mean, it can feel quite uncomfortable. But it is actually the way things are. You just got to get the hang of it. But anyway, maybe the reason why sometimes the Dharma can feel so imposed, because quite a bit of us, quite a bit of the time, is actually not in touch with the Dharma. Maybe we're not really seeing what life is for. We're confused, or maybe we have very different views about what we think the Dharma is. And then when actually our views start to collide with the reality of the Dharma, we can find it very, very uncomfortable. And you sort of see this. People get into Buddhism, they find it helpful, it kind of makes them a bit more relaxed, a bit more at ease, and so on. And they make a commitment to it, but then they find it doesn't seem to fit. And they react to it. It's all very painful. And it could just be because the way they see life actually is just very, very different from the Buddhist vision. They thought Buddhism was something. They thought the Dharma was something. Actually, and they committed on that basis. Actually, it's not like that. So we need to look at the Buddha's vision of life, the Buddha's vision of existence, to see how going for refuge, practicing the Dharma, is becoming more in tune with the way things are. We need to go back to the Buddha's visions. Going for refuge is founded on the Buddha's vision. The very motivation to go for refuge is founded on the Buddha's vision. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha arise out of the way things are. As I said, they're not artificial. They're not imposed. They are, in that sense, natural ideas. They are ideals. Not artificial ideals. They're natural ideals that arise from what is. They're not sort of ideas slapped onto life that we try and, you know, force ourselves into. They're not which oppress and distort. They arise from the very nature of existence, the very nature of human life. The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are the best, if you like, the highest human qualities taken to their highest pitch of intensity. But let's remind ourselves of the Buddha's vision of existence. Before doing that, it's worth reminding ourselves that in the end, when we talk about the Buddha's vision of existence, we're dealing with something that of unfathomable depth and profundity, that actually no set of words or concepts or doctrines can actually express. The doctrines and words and concepts that the Buddha uses to communicate that vision are extraordinarily important. They're not arbitrary. They're not, you know, you could have another form of words and you'd get to the same point. No. The words that the Buddha uses are very, very important. I'm going to say more about that in a talk later on in the week. But we need to remember that originally the Buddha's vision is a takavatara. It's beyond all concepts, all notions. So we find the Buddha, after his enlightenment, which is, of course, not just one experience, but a whole sequence of unfolding experiences, to use the word experience, which in a way doesn't apply at that level. But we find the Buddha reflecting this dharma, this truth, this reality that I have attained is profound. Word is gambhira in Pali and Sanskrit, which means deep, profound. This dharma that I have attained to is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. It is the most peaceful and subtle and supreme meaning and goal, not attainable by merely thinking on its own. Subtle for the wise to experience directly. It is hard for those with attachment, relishing attachment, to see this truth, namely praticca sammuppada, conditioned co-production. And it is hard to see this truth, the stilling of all conditioning, nirvana. So this is the Buddha contemplating the profundity of his attainment after his enlightenment. So you've got two great things here. You've got praticca sammuppada, conditioned co-production, and nirvana, the stilling or the transcending of all conditioning, all sanskaras. There's much to say here. We're dealing with very vast topics. You really do need to come on the Transcendental Principle retreat to get right into this stuff. But I do want us to remind ourselves of where we are with all this. So let's dwell first of all, and most importantly, on praticca samuppada, conditioned co-production or dependent arising. There are various translations of this term. It's best to get used to the Pali and the Sanskrit, praticca samuppada, conditioned co-production, interdependent co-arising, take your pick. So many descriptions of the Buddha's enlightenment describe his vision of existence in this way, and it's summed up in this great formula. This being, in the sense of this being so, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. This being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. It's so simple, apparently. But the formula expresses a vision. It's a kind of essential, the most sort of essentialized sort of summary, if that's the right word, of an extraordinary vision of existence. Last summer I was studying Sangharakshita's seminars on the Udana, a very old collection of Pali texts, and it's quite something to study a seminar of Sangharakshita's on texts like that, because he really tries to, you know, get right inside what the actual experience is, because those Pali texts can seem very sort of stiff, and especially in these sort of old-fashioned translations, and it can seem a bit dry and sort of rationalistic, as if the Buddha's sort of like a scientist almost, and he's just sort of tweaked this, you know, a bit of algebra or whatever it's called, this equation. So Sangharakshita, in his kind of in this attempt to kind of evoke what was really going on, which these words convey, he says that this vision that he has, which is summed up in this formula of conditioned co-production, he says, of course, it arises out of profound meditation. He said that the Buddha's meditation, it says it's as if the Buddha's meditation is like the gathering of all the kind of all the kind of waters. You can imagine all the waters flowing into a great river. And the river just flows to the edge of a cliff into a great torrent, a great waterfall. So he said that's really what the Buddha's meditation is like. You know, it's all these forces, all these energies, just flowing over the edge, as it were. And what they flow into is this direct vision. He says it comes in one flush, one flash, this great process of becoming. Okay, it's summed up in this being that becomes on the arising of this, or it's summed up in a word like becoming or arising and ceasing. But actually it's a vision that you cannot reduce, you cannot hold in any one concept. It completely transcends that. What the Buddha sees in one sort of timeless flash, if you can have a timeless flash, is no fixed, separate, unchanging being, but becoming. Not just random change either, but a sort of pattern to this becoming, to this condition co-production. And it seems that the Buddha himself sort of developed his insight into this and his teaching on this through his sort of teaching career. And he comes up with, there are passages where he talks about two great trends to this becoming, two great trends to this becoming. There's the cyclic trend, which are represented by the 12 cyclic nidanas that are depicted on the outer circle of the Tibetan Wheel of Life, where you see out of ignorance and craving all kinds of activities and attachments that lead to repeated birth and death and suffering, round and round and round. Sometimes the experiences will be pleasant, sometimes there'll be gain, but they'll be alternating with pain and loss. Round and round and round, up and down, up and down. It's a wheel of becoming. Samsara, as we call it. The limited, the cyclic. And the second great trend in the Buddha's vision of existence is progressive conditionality, what we've come to call the spiral conditionality. So this is still a becoming, but it's of a very different nature. Out of an awareness of the unsatisfactory nature of this cycle, out of dukkha, out of a sense that this is a cycle, this is a wheel, a sense of limitation, of pain, whatever it is, arises faith, shraddha, faith in the possibility of leaving the cyclic, of moving out beyond the cyclic. And out of that awareness of unsatisfactoriness, giving rise to that shraddha, that faith, out of that a progressive, cumulative unfoldment arises, going through all sorts of states towards complete liberation from the cyclic, complete transcendence in the end of all conditions, namely nirvana. And let's not forget that nirvana is described by the Buddha as paramang sukhang, the supreme bliss, the supreme satisfaction, the supreme good. So the Buddhist vision is this great vision of becoming. Praticca Samuppada. Nowhere in this vision is there anything that is permanent. Nowhere in this vision is there anything substantial. There's no Atman. There's no fixed, unchanging self. What you have are conditions, networks of conditions, giving rise to further networks of conditions. Conditions giving rise to further conditions. Either samsaric conditions or nirvanic conditions, cyclic or reactive conditions or progressive, positive, creative, spiral-like conditions. So this is the first thing that we need to get hold of, that everything is becoming, everything is praticca samuppada, and there's a cyclic, ultimately sort of painful form of conditionality, and a positive, progressive, ultimately blissful conditionality leading to nirvana. In later Buddhism, this praticca samuppada is also designated shunyata, emptiness, meaning emptiness in the sense of empty of any permanent and separate self. Emptiness doesn't mean that there's nothing. Doesn't mean anything like that. It's just another way of expressing conditioned co-production. Because everything is becoming, because everything is without substance, everything is shunyata. It means, and of course, this means because everything is like this, we have the potential to attain nirvana. This is very, very important. Or to bring this nearer to our experience, all of us have the potential to grow and develop. All of us have the potential to make real spiritual change, to make real change, because everything is change, if you like. All of us can make progress in the direction of enlightenment. All of us can liberate ourselves from the cyclic, from the habitual. This potentiality for this kind of growth and change in some schools of later Buddhism is called Tathagata Garbha, which is best translated as the seed of the Tathagata, the seed of Buddhahood. Because everything is change, it means we can change into a Buddha. We can evolve into a Buddha. That's the real meaning of Tathagatagarbha. It doesn't mean that you're fully enlightened already, complete with all the great powers and qualities of a Buddha. It does not mean that. It means that we have the potentiality to become a Buddha because everything is change. I used the word evolve just then. We can evolve into a Buddha. And in the early days, as you might be aware, Sangharakshita made a lot of this language of evolution. He gave two sets of lectures on what he called the higher evolution and referred to it quite a lot. So his argument was that, well, science tells us actually that life is becoming. Evolution describes a great becoming. It's one of the key words, I think, some of the Victorian evolutionists used. They used the language of becoming. They're describing growth and change. Human beings, then, like everything else, are essentially growing beings. We're growing beings. We want to grow. We kind of need to grow. But if we are to grow now, we can't leave it to nature. For further evolution, higher evolution, we need to get hold of our life. Our growth from now on needs to be individual. It needs to be conscious. It needs to be deliberate, because it's growth in consciousness. It's growth of consciousness. It's growth in awareness. It's growth of awareness. As human beings, we possess incredible potential. Incredible potential and capacity to develop our humanity. And there's something deep within us, deep within every single human being that wants to do this. This is another part of the Buddha's vision. If you like, he had a direct experience of the progressive conditionality, but it's in a way much more direct than that, where shortly after the contemplation of the profundity of the Dharma, he had that vision of all living beings being like lotus flowers in a great muddy swamp. Some are pushing up out of the swamp, opening to the light. Others are still buds stuck in the water. But all beings are essentially growing beings. And it's very interesting, as a little detail which people don't often pick up on. When the Buddha has this vision, it's his Buddha eye, his Buddha chakshu, that's actually doing the seeing. It's his eye of enlightenment. And when the Buddha eye sees, again, it means we're not going to be able to really know what that is. That's not explainable in a concept. It's actually beyond all language. It's something, you know, something direct that the Buddha's seeing. And it's interesting, he said, it is as if living beings are like lotus flowers. It is as if he's trying to communicate something that's direct, in the end inconceivable, his sense of living beings. And it says he sees with compassion. Although again, the Pali is very interesting, a very important detail which I never tire of talking about when I get the chance. The word for compassion, translated as compassion, is anukampa, which means literally to shake with, to tremble with. And I think this is if you take it literally, there's something so suggestive of this. It's as if the Buddha's full, complete, fully opened, if you like, potential. His enlightenment is trembling with the potential enlightenment, which is because living beings are growing beings. His compassion isn't a sort of looking down from on high on people's very obvious suffering. Actually, his compassion is a trembling with potential. It's almost a sort of joyous seeing of potential. And we know very well that the Buddha was always joyous when people awakened their potential through their communication with him. So I think that gives us quite an insight into the Buddha's compassion, as it's very often spoken about. What he wants, his compassion most of all, is to see that is to bring forth this potential in living beings. Because they suffer so much. We suffer so much because we don't bring that forth. We don't bring forth that potential. So we are essentially growing beings. I remember a lecture by Sangharakshita where he was talking about this, using this sort of language. And he says, when potential is frustrated, when growth is frustrated, well then, people start to, they can get destructive, of themselves and other people. And he just made a comment in that particular lecture and he said, and we do know that crime is on the increase. And I thought it was a very interesting detail. He was sort of almost sort of saying, look, this stuff happens because people are not being given the means to develop themselves as individuals along the path to enlightenment. I mean, that's why I think he's so pleased when, people actually start taking the Dharma out to new places. That seems to be the thing he loves most of all, when people actually are taking the Dharma. I was talking to Joe yesterday about the group, he's doing. And I said, Sangha actually would be so pleased to hear that and delighted in that, because it means people have the opportunity, we're giving them the chance to develop from what is deepest within them. Because if that isn't expressed, it's going to cause a lot of problems. But although this is deep within us, of course it doesn't just happen. Well, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't just happen that our lotus petals unfold to the sun of enlightenment. We don't just sort of live as human beings and bing, we're enlightened, or we find ourselves growing naturally on the path. It's not like that. As I've said, growth from now on, development from now on, has to take place in consciousness. It has to be deliberate and individual, which means that we've really got to get hold of our life. We have this incredibly precious human life, so rich with potential. But if there is to be any real growth and movement towards nirvana, we've got to do that ourselves. We've got to make a definite commitment to that path. And it really is up to us individually. And right now, yes, we can get all sorts of help in all sorts of ways. But in the end, we have to do the walking. We have to do the work. We have all these riches and possibilities. But what are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do with these riches and possibilities? What are we going to do with this life? In the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, they talk a lot about that what's called the bardo, the in-between, the space between two phases. We're most familiar with that, with the space between death and rebirth. But the Nyingma and in fact the general sort of, well, it goes back to an Indian teaching, actually, teaching on bardo, is far broader than that. But the Nyingma tradition distinguished six kinds of bardo. We'll talk about six kinds of in-between spaces of possibility. And they say human life itself is a bardo. That's the bardo we're in right now. That's the in-between. That's the space of possibility and potential that we're in right now. I'll just read you the verse that they have for meditating on this bardo, this in-between, the human bardo. It goes like this. Oh, now, when the bardo of life upon me is dawning, abandoning idleness, there being no idleness in a devotee's life, entering into the reality undistractedly, listening, reflecting, and meditating, carrying on to the path knowledge of the true nature of appearances and of mind. May the Trikaya be realized. Once that the human form has been attained, may there be no time or opportunity in which to idle it away. So this life is a bardo. But we're not given it indefinitely. Death is ever present. Death is inevitable in this human existence, and it's an ever-present possibility. Change is happening all the time. And even if we live long, even if we might have a long life, we're not young or youthful or healthy forever. As I say, life is change, it's impermanent. So what are we going to do with this life? What is our life really for? In relation to the fundamental question of being a conscious human being, living in the face of impermanence and death, what are we actually going to do? So it's very, very important to meditate on these kinds of questions. These are, in fact, the first of the two contemplations that are said to turn the mind to the Dharma. Turn the mind to the Dharma. Meditating on this precious human life and meditating on impermanence and death. They say that if you really have insight into these things, then your mind turns. It turns to the refuges. Your mind turns to the Dharma. So let's just consider briefly, first of all, this precious human life, this precious human existence. So it's a good idea to reflect on how incredible it is to be a human being. You know, sometimes people tell me, and I have lots of problems with the first stage of the Metta-Bhavana. And I often say these days, well, look, why not just sort of meditate on what you've got? You know, instead of thinking about what you haven't got, what have you got? Look, you're alive. You know, I mean, sometimes you're not sure whether people have actually recognised that sometimes, that they're actually living. You know, have a go at noticing how fantastic it is to breathe. You know, I mean, I suffer from sort of sinus trouble. So this morning, up in meditation, I can't breathe properly. I'm going, you know, or, no, not quite like that, but I'm sort of holding my nose so I don't sneeze. And it's a real drag, let me tell you. I mean, if none of you have that problem, well, I think you ought to try it sometimes, just so that you can, because when you actually breathe, it's just so fantastic. I mean, who needs anything else when you can actually breathe properly? It's just such a fantastic thing. So, first stage of the Metta-Bhavana, have a go at just noticing how fantastic it is to breathe. Or just to, you know, to feel things, just to notice, and to hear, to be able to hear and see and smell and taste. To be aware. This is just so fantastic. You can actually reflect on your experience. This is what they say about human life. They go through the realms, the meditation on the precious human birth. They'll say, talk about all the sort of misfortunes of, you know, being born in hell and being born as a hungry ghost and being born as a jealous god and being even born as a god, being born as an animal. And the problems with those states is that you're overwhelmed by a particular state, whether it's craving or hatred or pain or madness or bliss. That's a problem. You know, so if you're blissed out people having a groovy life, you're in trouble. Not looking at anybody in particular. But the thing about human life is that you can actually stand back from experience. You can be in experience, but you can reflect. We've got this wonderful thing called self-consciousness in the positive sense, reflexive consciousness. You know, that we can actually sort of, you know, we're in the midst of something, but we don't actually have to act on that state. We can actually do something about it. It means also we've got such a thing as an imagination, not in the sense of daydreaming or a fantasy, but an imagination that can sort of see that there can be something better and different, that can intuit even enlightenment. Fantastic. Incredible that we've got these particular gifts. So, you know, when you're beating yourself up and, oh, I've had a really difficult life and I wasn't given this and wasn't given that, you know, it might all be true, but hey, you know, you've got these immense riches, So precious human life. We've got so much ability, so much capacity, so much potential. We need to sort of meditate on that. We've also got a lot of freedom. I know we have a very regulated world and costs a lot of money to live and all that sort of thing, but you actually have the freedom to go on retreat. I mean, there are some parts of the world you would not have that freedom. There are people who are in so much toil, they have to work so hard, they're never going to get time off to go on retreat. Or they're living in environments, in societies, where they wouldn't be free to be a Buddhist. No chance, no way that you could get a group of people to live from their conscience in the sense of actually living from what they believe to be true. So we have enormous freedoms and a relatively stable world, actually. I know not all parts of the world, people from different parts of the world here are in stable environments, but it's relatively stable, you could say, and that gives us immense freedom. They talk about the precious human life endowed with leisure. Leisure, what if I work so hard and so on, but you've got the leisure, you've got some time to give to what is important, you've got some time and space to that. Some people don't have that, they don't have the space to even think. So we need to do something with this. We need to turn to what's really important. Well, you know, we perhaps ask ourselves, well, what is really important to us? Well, is it actually the Dharma? Is it actually going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha? Is it actually wanting to be ordained? You know, wanting to commit yourself to the spiritual path? Is it that? Is it nirvana? Or is it something else? I mean, it's okay if it's something else. I mean, one of the things that I think is really important to get hold of, you know, that you don't have to be a Buddhist. You don't have to go for refuge. You don't have to enter into the order. I mean, if you think that it's much better to do something else with your life, then really go for that. One of the saddest things, I think, is when I see people, and I even see it in our movement, in states of sort of chronic doubt. Chronic doubt. You know, and you see the years sort of slipping by with them. Slipping by, and they've still got this doubt. Shall I do this? Shall I do that? You know, and, you know, shall I be a musician? Shall I be an artist? Shall I have a family? Shall I go for refuge? Shall I gain nirvana? And they never do anything. And you want to say, look, just do something. It doesn't matter. It actually doesn't matter what it is. But please do something with all of your being, because life is too short and too precious to waste it in this sort of state. So when we think like this about precious human life, we have to ask ourselves, what am I actually doing? Maybe it's a kind of mixture with us, you know, that sometimes we're sort of really focused on moving towards nirvana and sometimes we're not. And that's okay, just so long as we, you know, we're aware of what's happening and we know what's going on. Life is so precious, and there's so many riches for us to discover. So let's make the most of this precious human life. Life is very precious, but it's taking place in this context of impermanence and death. You know, that this body, this world is so impermanent. I think it's in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha where Vimalakirti is he's sick and he gives this amazing teaching about this body is so impermanent, so fragile. And it's that so. It's not just impermanent. It's so impermanent. You know, everything, you know, we really do have to pay attention to this. And as Dogen says, you don't have to sort of think something up and then take it away to do impermanence. He says, just look. It's a fact before your eyes. It's right in front of you in all its starkness. Everything is change. You know, the sun rises in the morning. It sets in the evening. Day and night following one another. And of course, there's the seasons. We're at that sort of interface of seasons, which is a, you know, which is always a sort of strange time, because you can feel the sort of burgeoning of spring, but winter's still hanging on, isn't it? So there's that, you know, I find this quite a weird time of year myself. And I think it's because things are changing, and it's all very visible. The life of a man, we are born, we enter childhood, we enter youth, maturity, old age, death. Friends meet and part, you know, with every meeting there is parting. Empires arise and pass away, worlds, galaxies arise and pass away, banks arise and pass away. You know, those really solid institutions, you know, with all those respectable people in them, are deeply flawed, deeply impermanent and insubstantial. And then there's death, and the meditation on death, the Tibetans, well, Buddhist tradition generally, is very thorough with their meditations on these different things. And the death meditation, I find, it's particularly sort of thorough. They talk about sort of three root meditations that you need to sort of really establish in your consciousness. First of all, death is inevitable. It's completely unavoidable. There is no way you can avoid it. It happens to absolutely everyone. Even the Buddha couldn't cheat death. You know, he attained parinirvana, but his physical body came to an end. It's inevitable. So don't sort of, it's not if, it's when. It's going to happen. So we just have to get that notion in our mind of the inevitability of death. And then secondly, the second great meditation on death, it's uncertain when it will happen. It can happen at any moment. It can happen in the next second. It could happen next week, next month, next year. You just do not know when it's going to happen. So we need to meditate on the uncertain time of death. And then the third great meditation on death is at the time of death, only the Dharma can actually help. Only the Dharma, in the sense of the Dharma that generates awareness, love, clarity, courage, and so on. You need the Dharma. You need something that is going to generate those qualities, so that when you face, when death comes, you are ready and you can respond to death creatively. And the Buddhist tradition, it's only the refuges, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that are going to actually provide that. But, you know, is that so? Do we actually really think like that? In the face of impermanence and death, you know, we are this being towards death, as I think Heidegger refers to it as. In the face of that, where do we actually go? Where do we turn to in the face of impermanence and death? Do we actually go for refuge more intensively to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha? Or do we go somewhere else when we reflect on impermanence and death? What is our refuge? What makes us feel all right? What gives us a sense of deep meaning? People sometimes say, and I think I used to think it myself, that they sometimes say, well, if I really saw death, if I had a brush with death and impermanence, I'd make more effort. If only I could have that, a real brush with death, and then I'd go for it. But then I used to notice people who did have those brushes with death, and they didn't end up, you know, like really going for enlightenment. I found that really interesting what they did. I mean, in some cases they made an absolute bolt for the world, you know, it was like marriage, kids, mortgage, house, everything. I mean, I'm not criticizing them for that or anything. I'm not saying that was a, you know, a bad option, but I mean, it was like, hang on, what do I really want to do with my life in the face of this? What's important? And it certainly wasn't, you know, attaining enlightenment for all beings. All sorts of ways people respond in all sorts of ways to those brushes with death. The famous sort of midlife crisis of men of a certain age, which can sometimes look a bit like delayed adolescent rebellion, as Sangharakshita called it, describing the behaviour of some order members. I don't know if he included me in that, but never mind. not so much a delayed adolescent rebellion, but a continuous adolescent rebellion. Anyway, that's another point. We might just notice that we're sort of growing older. It's like, hang on, there's not much time left. What am I going to do with it? And is it plunging more deeply into the Dharma, or is it something else? What is our refuge really? What do we really believe will give us security, meaning, truth, happiness, fulfillment, beauty, depth, in relation to this profoundly impermanent, insubstantial, ever-changing existence? Where do we go? So finding a refuge then is existential. It's to do with our very being in this world. Sometimes people say, well, I don't like the language of refuge. And it's like, look, unenlightened beings go for refuge. It's what unenlightened beings do. You know, we're all the time trying to feel all right, trying to create security, get security, find meaning, whatever. It's what human beings do. It's just that Buddhism has identified that basic activity and is saying, all right, you know, you want refuge, find something that really does work in the face of the ravages of impermanence and death. So the question is it a true refuge, or is it a refuge that will break down and that will, in the end, not satisfy and fulfill? So tomorrow's talk, we're going to be looking at, if you like, we could call it the search for refuge tomorrow. Okay. Thank you.